Although the George W. Bush Institute reports on its website that, I'm quoting, Afghan women have made hard-won gains in the past decade. Today, girls can attend school, women hold important positions in local and national government, and play a vital role in the economy. That may paint an overly optimistic picture. Women continue to face very serious threats. And the head of the EU's delegation to Afghanistan, Franz Michael Melbin, declared in March that it is the worst place on earth to be a woman. In an article called Love Crimes, What Liberation Looks Like for Afghan Women, in this month's Harper's Magazine, Jen Percy reports on her travels to Afghanistan, where she investigated what conditions have been like for women since the U.S. invasion, and if, in some respects, they may have even worsened. I'm pleased to welcome Jen Percy to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You tell so many horrifying stories in this article. The one that seems to really encapsulate a lot of threats facing women is Malika's. Didn't bad luck find Malika early?
It did, and actually I found Malika's story already written about before I started reporting on it further. And she grew up in Helmand Province and basically was going to be executed by her brothers for falling in love with another boy in the village and ran away from home to basically be saved by the Americans, and was then subsequently shipped to a shelter in Kabul. And that's sort of where the newspaper report ended that I read. And so I was following up on her story.
Well, she was cross-eyed possibly from being hit early in life. Her father was hanged for theft when she was three. Her brothers were drug dealers.
Yeah, they were hanging out with the Taliban, smoking heroin. Basically, from her narrative, when I talked to her, she worked from sunup to sundown, was illiterate, no education, no opportunities in life.
Her mother was forced to remarry after her father was hanged. Did Malika's new father and her brothers have plans for her?
Their plans for her was that she would just take care of the household. That was her only option.
Hmm. And then there was an arranged marriage, wasn't there? Or
yeah, so her brothers decided that she would marry an old farmer, and she didn't have the opportunity necessarily to meet him or get to know him or have any say in the decision, and at the same time had been wishing to marry this other man.
Although her mother helped her with the other man, Sarwar is his name?
Yeah, that's an interesting part of the story.
Her
mother
bought
her
a
cell
phone.
Right, exactly, which ironically is what ends up getting Malika in trouble in the end.
Are girls or women allowed to have cell phones?
They are, but it depends on what part of the country you're in and what, you know, who you're talking to, different tribal customs. But many, many women in Afghanistan have access to cell phones, but that doesn't necessarily mean that family members are supporting their use, because usually they assume that the women are talking to other men.
Wasn't another girl in her village shot for having one?
Yes, exactly.
And then they discovered that Malika had one. What happened? She was beaten.
Yeah, they decided to give her her last meal after they beat her nearly to death with a stick. And they would hang her after that last meal, which she refused. She tried to kill herself during that small break by eating rat poison, which is a pretty common method for women in Afghanistan to try to kill themselves. It didn't work, and so she decided to just make a run for it.
And she ran for the Americans. What happened when she arrived there? Were the Marines prepared to deal with someone like her?
You know, she had pretty good reception, I think, because they were making efforts, counterinsurgency efforts to, you know, support the communities and empower local communities, especially women, that they were, you know, of course, concerned about security. But after they found out that she really was in harm's way, wanted to bring her in to sort of, you know, support the kind of work they'd been doing. So surprisingly, they took her in and took care of her until the end.
Did the Taliban have anything to say about this story?
Yeah, the Taliban, as reported by Major Larson, who took care of Malika during this period, that the Taliban were spreading rumors that America just wanted to rape their women, and that was their liberation, that the Marines were raping Malika.
Which wasn't true.
Which was not true.
On the other hand, women are often vulnerable to rape. in all societies, but in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and in Afghanistan, if a woman is raped, then it's often, you know, the fault of the woman. So if she's raped, that means she can go to jail.
She's blamed for enticing the man, or just she's just seen as a fallen person?
I don't even know if the conversation gets that complicated. It's more that her honor's lost, so she no longer has any use. So then she's, you know, it's shameful for the family now to have her be a part of the group.
Your article begins with Gul Raham, a hymen doctor in Kabul, who issues certificates of virginity.
Yeah, I was wondering about finding this hymen doctor before I even left and didn't expect to find him.
Is this a common specialty?
I don't know if hymen doctor would be an official name, of course. Forensic scientist. But he had this filing cabinet full of virginity certificates where women would come in, either brought in by parents or shelters or police officers, and they had to say, okay, I'm a virgin or not. And sometimes their hymen would be broken, but they still needed a certificate to say if it was broken in a way that was, an accident or...
riding a bicycle or
yes,
something.
Yes, exactly.
And that can very well happen.
Yeah, with great frequency, I believe.
Does he consider himself a true man of science?
Yeah, he insisted on that, even though he believed that condoms cause cancer. So there were some, alarms going off there.
If parents suspect their daughters have been raped, do they take them to see this doctor?
Yeah, they can. But it has to be through an official organization, generally.
Now, if a man rapes a woman and then offers to marry her, does she have to marry him?
If a man rapes a woman and wants to marry her, well, usually the woman doesn't have say, but it depends really on which family you're asking. There's quite a few liberal families in Kabul, but more likely than not, she would be in harm's way if she didn't marry him, because then she would have, you know, her hymen would be broken. The next husband most likely wouldn't accept her into the marriage. So that's the circumstance where, yes, it benefits the woman to marry her rapist.
I'm speaking with Jen Percy, whose article, Love Crimes, What Liberation Looks Like for Afghan Women, is in this month's Harper's Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. If a husband suspects his wife of having an affair, would he bring her to this doctor?
You know, I don't know what the numbers are for husbands coming to the center to check out their wives, but I do know, when I was there, we talked about a few, and one of them who had brought his wife in, apparently she was fine. She hadn't been messing around on him. And so as a result, he could be brought to jail or shamed, and everyone was making fun of him.
For suspecting it.
So, it's a line that can be dangerous for the men to cross, too, in some ways, because it's humiliating their honorable wife then.
Isn't it true that even women walking unaccompanied can be subjected to a virginity exam?
Yeah, in Kabul, sometimes police officers are stopping women.
So this is not a city-country kind of thing. People in the city aren't any more enlightened about male-female relations than they might be in the country?
No, I would say, I think Kabul is, it's a time warp. It's much more developed and advanced than the provinces. But that doesn't mean that it's, consistent necessarily throughout.
Didn't your first interpreter quit because of the line of your investigation?
Yeah,
he was
very uncomfortable with my questions. And that was sort of an interesting part of being a woman and going over there, to write about something so, sexually oriented, is because the men didn't want to talk to me because I'm a woman. But then I had an advantage because I was a woman who would then get to talk to the women about these problems, which, is an opportunity I don't think they have very often. But my fixer initially did not want to talk about that, so I got another one.
You are not only a woman, but you are a blonde Western woman.
Yeah.
Is that a positive or a negative when you try to investigate a story like this?
Well, what I was told, there's two things. First of all, we've been there for, over a decade, so they're used to having Western women there. But My fixer is also, most of the time, I had a male fixer, and then sometimes I had a female interpreter if I was talking about very private issues with women. But over and over again, people kept telling me that they just consider Western women just this third gender. They don't even know what to do with us. And so they just kind of treat us like men. I never necessarily felt like they were disrespecting me. It felt like they were giving me some power because they were mostly confused.
Were the women open to talking to you?
They were, yeah. They were actually really grateful to see me. They were often, you know, before they told their stories, at least smiling and happy and eager to speak. So that was a great experience that, you know, but only if I had a female fixer with me. Not if if a man was in the room, they would not do that. So it changed things completely.
What did Dr. Rahman say when you asked him about the use of tampons and whether they might be blamed for puncturing a hymen?
Oh, so when I asked about tampons, they just didn't know what the word was. There's a translation issue there, and they thought I was talking about condoms the whole time.
Which he says cause cancer.
Yeah, which caused cancer. So
did they give you any reason for thinking that?
No. I didn't investigate further into that line, yeah.
He keeps a file entitled Light Torture. What's in it?
Oh, so torture victims also come to this forensic center. And so the mutilated women and torture victims are often the ones coming up. So Light Torture, you know, I'm not sure exactly what that's coming from, but he showed me a file just to give an example of some other work he did.
When you saw Dr. Rahman, you also had the opportunity to visit the morgue. And it was specifically for mutilated women. Why are women mutilated? Under what circumstances and how?
Well, it was a mix of torture victim or unidentified bodies of men. So there were a few men in there. But that's where all the mutilated women that they were finding in Kabul were ending up. So they were investigating, you know, if it was, you know, rapes, if someone, you know, like Malika, she could have died from that initial beating. When I arrived, a woman had her nose and lips cut off. There was a pregnant woman hanged from a tree. So these kinds of women.
And is there a reason that they cut off the nose and the lips?
I mean, I don't know if they're thinking that. Of course, it could be potentially symbolic to cut off lips. But also mutilating, you know, a face is sort of mutilating a woman's beauty, her appearance, humiliating her.
And once you lose a nose.
Yeah. Yeah. And that case was just because he needed money to buy heroin, you know, so it wasn't even necessarily a moral issue at that point between their relationship.
How serious is the heroin addiction problem in Afghanistan? Is it countrywide?
As far as I know, it is. I'm definitely not an expert on heroin use.
Was it mostly men?
No, there was actually a center I almost went to that was for women recovering from heroin addiction. And, you know, a lot of it starts, too, because of abusive relationships and they turn to drugs. And that was sort of a line I was following for a while. But, you know, everywhere I went, I was seeing homeless addicts.
When you arrived in Kabul in December 2013, a lot of women were running away from home. Why then?
Well, it's interesting because the foreigners had set up a lot of what seemed to be amazing programs. They had the Human Rights Commission, the Ministry of Women's Affairs, these shelters. So there's a place for women now to flee. They were going towards something. And they were also starting to learn about their rights, access to cell phones, television, radio,
the internet,
a call center, the internet. So they're, you know, able to see how other women were living. And when they learned that they could go somewhere else, you know, they ran.
And what happens if they're caught?
So if they're caught, it depends on who they're caught by. But if they're caught by their parents, they might deal with it within the family. But a lot of women, even if they're caught by their parents, get sent to the police. And after that, they generally go to a jail called Badambagh, and it's specifically for women. And most of the crimes in there, I mean, it sounds like it would be like a middle school locker room. It's mostly like she kissed a boy, You know, these two, a boy and a girl, were talking over here. You know, it's, and they're in there for years and years because of this.
In 2012, Human Rights Watch reported that 70% of the 700 women incarcerated were there because they had run away from home. The reasons that were given were abusive husbands, forced prostitution, rape, unhappy marriages, and yet they were the ones who wound up being punished. Do you think this is partly – now, many people say arranged marriages actually are a good idea. They work very well in some cultures. Do you think it's one of the problems in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it's a deeply misogynistic culture, and it's going to be really hard to – even if we're able to bring policy, build infrastructure, invest in education, that the stereotype – And the cultural traditions of women being inferior to men, as is consistent in Pashtunwali, for example, a tribal norm, especially prominent in the south of Afghanistan, doesn't mean the actions will change or the perceptions will change. So if a woman, you know, is raped or forced to prostitution, she is now soiled. It's not necessarily about her rights. It's about how that reflects on men in the family.
You report on one girl who ran away to live in a shelter, and a family allowed her to return, but the village didn't accept her, and they killed her?
Yeah, they killed her.
And was there some kind of a tribal meeting first, some kind of judicial process?
I didn't read about a judicial process. They do have, you know, informal meetings often, but for this one, I think it was that was not mentioned in the article that I read.
My guest is Jen Percy. Her article, Love Crimes, What Liberation Looks Like for Afghan Women, is in this month's Harper's Magazine. We will continue our conversation right after this. And we are back with Jen Percy. Her article, Love Crimes, What Liberation Looks Like for Afghan Women, is in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. Isn't there a law that was passed? 2009, President Hamid Karzai signed the Elimination of Violence Against Women Act. It sounds like it's had no impact.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really important law passed, but hasn't necessarily been acted upon. Does it mean it's the rules are being, you know, enacted? Women have, you know, been reporting their, you know, issues of violence, but they're not being, the men aren't being prosecuted for it. I think it's only risen 2% since the law was enacted.
And the law lists 22 acts of violence prohibited, the punishment for being convicted for any of them. And the courts are just ignoring it?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's some problems. There's a lot of the women aren't even making it to their trial necessarily. Another issue is that there's not that many women within the legal system. And when I talked to several women about speaking in court about violations, they were very uncomfortable talking about rape or sexual assault in front of males. And so often they lie.
And haven't religious authorities declared that the Elimination of Violence Against Women Act is un-Islamic?
Yeah, while I was there...
What is it? The Quran doesn't say you can rape a woman.
Well, they want to – I mean, there's sort of three laws going on in Afghanistan now. There's the sort of Afghan penal code, there's Sharia law, and then there's tribal and moral customs. And so they're constantly being reinterpreted, they're mixing together. And it's hard to find any consistency, and that's the real problem, is no one really quite knows what the law is. In Kabul, the same crime might be, you know, interpreted differently than it would be in Helmand. And so – if, you know, authorities feel like they're losing power or they don't want women to have rights, then they might, you know, simply, declare something that would have a support among, you know, the population, which would be to say it's un-Islamic. This is not something you should be doing right now. So it's, you know, it's a power issue, too.
How much of this is also because Afghanistan is made up of many different tribes and they all have their own customs? You kind of suggested that, but Pashto would be quite different than the Tajiks or the people who live near Iran, the Shia of the south.
Yeah, it's a huge problem, and I think that when I was talking to a couple experts, they were initially saying that, you know, if we invest, they invested in $904 million in rule of law funding between 2002 and 2010. And, well, where did that go? Well, a lot of it went to foreign experts in Kabul and infrastructure in Kabul, but then it didn't translate necessarily to the tribal regions. And there was even a report issued that said that that would be mostly impossible for that to function well in the tribal regions, and that most of the men and women in the provinces prefer to go to Taliban courts, you know, or local, you know, judges.
What about that, what I opened with, that report from the George W. Bush Institute that said Afghan women today, well, girls can attend school, women hold important positions in local and national government, play vital roles in the economy. Is that not true?
I mean, it is and it isn't. I think that's not, the question isn't whether, you know, necessarily have women's rights improved. And here's a couple examples. Sure. I mean, during the Taliban era, women had no rights at all. So really progress, you know, is quickly.
Women can walk down the street unaccompanied.
Yeah, I mean, many things have happened. I think the real problem is how we're applauding ourselves as a country for, you know, giving women liberation, and what have we done, and can we sustain that? So there has been a lot of progress, but I don't think we've looked beyond, you know, 2015. And, you know, for example, the shelters I went to, that seems like a huge accomplishment, and it is. The women go to the shelters. They have some, you know, legal rights. They get to talk to some authorities and are away from danger. But what do they do after that? Well, they're kicked out after a couple of years. I mean, it's not solving a problem. It's simply, you know, putting a Band-Aid on the issue right now. And, you know, when I was there, a woman police officer in Helmand was shot. There's still not room for them to make their way into those positions as security is you know, dissolving. So it's positive and negative. I don't think we can kind of think of it just as an accomplishment without looking at the dangers surrounding each issue.
And now the Taliban controls large swaths of the country. And I don't know if they've become any less repressive than they were when they were in total power.
Well, oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if they've become less repressive, but I mean, we've established enough security that there's still, you know, opportunities to be had. It's I think, an area of real uncertainty right now. You know, in Kabul is, you know, women like Fawzia Koofi, for example, are really making a lot of progress. She wants to run for president during the next elections.
And a woman ran for president in the last election. Didn't have a chance, but she ran.
Yeah, exactly.
You met with Sayeda Mustafavi, who's the policy director of the Ministry of Women's Affairs, a lecturer in journalism at Kabul University. And she says she meets a lot of women within a year who are runaways.
Yeah, she's sort of the gatekeeper, and she decides if a woman should go into the shelter or not. And of course, she mostly permits them to go, but sometimes there's a few instances where you know, the girl might be lying or being overly manipulative about a situation. But she checks them all in, keeps records of the situation.
And she says she sees about 6,000 women a year have run away. The total number last year was 50,000. Do you think it's higher this year?
I don't know. I mean, that it was a problem to keep track of the numbers because there hasn't been a good system for it. So it depends on which institution you ask and which person you ask. And it also necessarily doesn't, you know, what does it mean even if the numbers increase, because the opportunities for women reporting the numbers has increased. So there's not necessarily a correlation to be made. We could even see that as a positive thing because that means they're actually getting the word out about these abuses.
You visited shelters for women. What were they like?
Well, it was interesting because I wasn't allowed to go with a male fixer, and I wasn't necessarily even allowed to go in my own vehicle. So I was often picked up and then, you know, sort of driven around in a way that was very confusing. Went to a building. I didn't quite know where I was or what was going on. They all look the same. They're not labeled. They move around. You know, so they're secret. They're illegal. And there's about, you know, anywhere from, you know, when I saw 20, 25 women, in each of them. And they
could they bring their children?
Yeah, there were children there. And, you know, it just it would look like a regular house, really. And they all slept on bunk beds and there was a doctor's room. But they were just, you know, they weren't allowed to leave. So they were just bored out of their minds.
And then you say that they're forced to leave. But you met Mara, who had been in the shelter for over 2 years. What was her story?
Yeah, so they don't necessarily kick the women out, even though foreign funding might depend on a policy where the women aren't allowed to stay for, you know, more than a year or two. But, yeah, the stories were just horrendous. So Mara's husband was beating her.
Who's a heroin addict.
Who's a heroin addict. And he threatened to kill her children. And she now is in a weird situation because the only way she can get out of a shelter is if she marries a man. But no one's going to want her because, you know, she's sort of this, you know, typically soiled woman.
And she has children.
Yeah, and she has children, but she can't bring them with her into a new marriage either because that's tradition, is that the men won't accept a new wife's children.
Didn't her husband try to sell her children or sell them?
Yeah, he did. He tried to sell the children for heroin.
Another girl you met was Gulchira. What mm-hmm. was her story?
Yeah, Gulchira, she was very young and had been kidnapped from her father's house and brought north, I think, to Pakistan, where she was kept and basically used as a sex toy. And eventually, it was just by luck that she escaped. Apparently, a couple of the commanders were rivals, and one wanted to piss off another one, so they returned her to the Human Rights Commission, basically, as a revenge. So she ended up, you know, in a better place for that. But her father ended up murdering the commander, and now he's in jail.
He's in jail.
Yeah.
The commander wouldn't have gone to jail.
No, he was dead.
But yeah. Even then, from what you said earlier, it sounds unlikely that they would have prosecuted the commander. But they prosecute the father who killed this man.
Exactly.
Many people would have understood his reasons for doing that.
Yeah.
You write that Fawzu Koofi, a member of parliament, believes that violence against women is now a matter of revenge against foreigners.
That was one of the more frightening things I heard, I think. Kind of terrifying to think that they're sort of hitting these spots that are, you know, completely unfair and necessarily unrelated to sort of the terms of the war, but are punishing us for sort of, I think that women had been sort of perhaps even pawns at the beginning of the war. We were advocating war based on the need for women's rights. And so to think that we're being punished for that, is frightening and feels sort of hopeless in that statement. She was the first person to really bring that idea up. But a lot of other women too were saying, you know, how much we needed to educate, focusing on men, focusing on educating men about women as a place to start as well.
Well, now that the United States is withdrawn from Afghanistan, I know there'll still be some presence, but it will not be what it was. What do you think that's going to mean for the women who have looked to the United States as a way of getting out of these terrible situations?
Yeah, and I don't necessarily have an answer to that, but that's the question I asked the women continuously, and there was sort of this silence that overcame them. They just kind of didn't want to talk about it. So there's terror. Foreign funding is what supports the shelters, so those could potentially collapse. And I think a lot of the hope felt like it was, you know, remained with a younger generation and empowering youth and hoping that, you know, by the time, we can get youth politicized and get them more active. Because right now, the generation, for them is not going to necessarily make active change.
Should I assume that the most vulnerable women are the ones who have not been educated, the ones who are illiterate usually? Or does it not matter as long as you're a woman?
I don't know. I mean, I think that a lot of the women in power are immediate targets, you know. Fawzi Koofi has been attacked, and you know, any woman sort of trying to get to be a police officer is attacked, et cetera. But illiterate, I mean, most of the population is illiterate, but they're especially vulnerable because they're trying to get out of a situation. And one of the women at the shelters who I talked to was manipulated by even a mother of a man who kidnapped her eventually and brought her to Australia because she promised, you know, money and wealth. And they just don't have any support system or means to understand if a situation is dangerous or not.
There also seem to be mixed signals. A couple of years ago, I saw a documentary about a TV show that was the equivalent of American Idol. May have been called Afghan Idol. And the most popular performer was a woman, but she also received death threats, first of all, for just appearing on it, mm-hmm. but also because she kind of wiggled her body while she sang her song.
And that was from Afghanistan?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It was on Afghan television.
Right, exactly. So, and this is sort of the heart of the issue. It's you know, the women that are brave enough now to sort of flaunt any sort of liberation or empowerment, you know, there's people with guns pointing at them and threats. So,
are you going to go back to Afghanistan?
I don't know.
Is there anything more to find out about the situation? It sounds pretty dire.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm definitely going to keep my eye on it. I plan on going actually to Turkey and the border with Syria in February.
And well, don't cross the border and into
the
Islamic State, please.
Yeah, but not necessarily Afghanistan right now. But they'll definitely would. I mean, I thought it was a beautiful country, and I would love to kind of keep track on what's happening. Physically beautiful, and the people I met were very, very generous.
So that's the other side. You, not everybody is as terrible as the people who are engaging in these awful acts.
Right,
which is
you know, all we really see on the news, and it was nice to see. In some ways, I mean, it was just so ordinary sometimes that it was shocking. I was able to order a hamburger to my door. I used U.S. dollars. You know, there's some beautiful museums and stores. And, you know, so it's very shocking to arrive there after sort of being given images by the media and trying to make sense of that.
What was the sense that the country will hold out against the Taliban in the near future? This new government, we have very little time, but this new government will be an improvement?
I don't know. I feel like right now it's sort of, we're at this point where our narrative about the war is collapsing a bit, and we had perhaps good intentions that we were sort of promulgating in the media, but now we're starting to see areas of deception.
Jen Percy's article, Love Crimes, What Liberation Looks Like for Afghan Women, is in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.